You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. August is Local Food Month here in New Mexico. We'll be hearing all about it in just a moment. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Denise Miller. She is with the New Mexico Farmers Marketing Association, and Alex Pino. He's a farmer with Revolution Farm. Welcome.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So we're here to talk about local food, and it's the beginning of August, and this is Local Foods Connect Month. I didn't even know until recently that there was this whole association, Denise, that you were involved with that is all about marketing local food. Tell us about what you do, basically, and how that works.
Sure. Well, the New Mexico Farmers Marketing Association has been around 25 years, and we do a whole host of things that help build the local food system. So that really includes working with producers and consumers and everything in between to try to support all of the networks that help create a local food system. So there's an awful lot of different programs embedded in that work.
So a local food system, I mean, we are living in industrial America and so many people eat food grown who knows where. What are the advantages of eating local food?
Well, you really just kind of hit the nail on the head as far as the benefits of eating local. When you buy directly from farmers, which you can do at your local farmers markets, you are getting to meet the people who grow your food, and you can ask them any kind of question that you want about the way they grow their food, the different practices. You know where they're farming. It's usually traveling a really short distance to get to you. It is usually picked within 24 hours of your visit to that market. So knowing where your food comes from is an important aspect of buying local. There's also a lot of good that comes from supporting local farmers, because that money is going to stay in your community. The farmers are purchasing other products from the community. They say that for every dollar that's spent on local food, $1.80 is recirculated in the community. So you're really helping your local economy. The farmers are keeping agricultural knowledge alive, which is really important. They're keeping water in usage and protecting land. So there's all kinds of benefits that come from eating local food and buying both directly from farmers at farmers markets, as well as you can also buy local food increasingly at grocery stores. You can also eat at restaurants that purchase directly from farmers. There's lots of ways of supporting local food.
Let's also talk about the health benefits.
Okay.
More nutrition in fresh local food.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's measurable, isn't it?
It is. There's science. For a long time, they didn't exactly know what the measurable nutrient difference was between eating something that was fresher and something that had traveled a greater distance. But now there is a lot of science that really backs up the amounts of phytonutrients that are in, that the fresher the food is, the stronger the health benefits.
Alex, how did you become a farmer?
Kind of accidentally. I mean, it wasn't, I don't know if it was completely intentional, but...
Was it in the family?
My mom's side of the family has a lot of farmers, but I'm not, I mean, that's back in the Midwest, so I left there before I even knew I wanted to be a farmer.
So what set your direction?
Usually I just tell people it was a lot of unfulfilling jobs, like a series of unfulfilling jobs, but also just this, you know, this industrialized food system that you guys are talking about, and the chain of labor and the chain of exploitation on laborers and on the environment kind of just led me to thinking that farming was a tangible solution to a lot of those issues, and, you know, better than building homes or better than doing other things that I could be doing. So yeah, just a tangible solution to a pretty screwed up food system.
Well, you guys are really at the cutting edge of healthy food in so many ways. I mean, you do Beyond Organic. You do, you know, no-till and things that have to do with, or low-till, that have to do with all kinds of ecological and water, what would you call it, water-friendly farming? How does that, give us sort of a, like a sense of what that looks like day to day.
Yeah, like on the farm. So like with organic practices, I mean, you can still spray certain herbicides and pesticides if they're approved for organic use. OMRI is what the institution is that approves that stuff. But essentially what I do is if a crop is failing, it's for a whole nother reason. So I'm not even going to really treat it with an insecticide or with something like a row cover to keep that bug out. I'll just try to time the crop appropriately so that I'm not using a bunch of single-use plastics and petrochemicals. So essentially I'm just growing crops in a ecological way that works with the environment as it is. So like we just planted radishes last week because it finally cooled off. And those are going to be storage radishes for the winter. But if I had planted those a month ago, they would have germinated and just kind of gotten fried by the hot sun, even though I got the irrigation on with drip lines and everything. So just the idea of working with nature to produce food. But yeah, without too much outside input, if that makes sense. Like instead of bringing in compost and manure, I'm doing a lot of cover cropping, which is just growing certain plants and mowing and incorporating that into the soil prior to planting a crop.
One of the things that is so clear when you start talking to farmers about this kind of thing is that the more you are attuned to your environment, the better you can do on the one hand, but it's hard. I mean, you know, that thing that you learned that you do with the radishes, I can only imagine that you learned that by having done the wrong thing in another year.
Yeah, I did it right one year and I was like, oh, that's the week to do it, you know, wait till the monsoons hit and then plant them. But even right now we have such bad flea beetles that, you know, the radishes are up and they've got their little first leaves, but the flea beetles are peppering holes in there. So it's like, I'm just hoping the radishes can grow faster than they can be consumed, because they'll die if there's too many pests eating them.
So that's the downside of not using pesticides.
Right. Like I could probably spray something or put a row cover up for the flea beetles, but instead I just try to really foster this really healthy plant that's going to be able to fend off that pest and get past it. But yeah, it's pretty nerve-wracking sometimes.
Yeah, and the number of variables that farmers deal with is really remarkable. I mean, not only are they dealing with Mother Nature and everything that, you know, Alex just mentioned, but if you can also imagine on top of that, that when certain crops are ready to be harvested, everybody else's same crops are ready to be harvested. So in a world where you're selling something, you've got all of a sudden now you're selling peaches when everybody has peaches, and your radishes are ready when everybody has radishes. So that's another challenge that local farmers have, is opening markets. That's one of the things we've been trying to do recently, is open some new markets for farmers, so that in addition to them selling directly to the public at a farmer's market, they have other outlets for their crops.
Well, like apricots. There's apricots everywhere. There's apricots on the streets. What do you do at this time of year? How can you support farmers in a kind of deluge of apricots?
Right. No, it's a good question. I think they're having a hard time selling apricots right now. But one of the things we've done that started in 2018, we have a value chain project. And so we hired someone who is our value chain coordinator. And what that means is he is trying to shorten the link. A value chain it's basically kind of like a supply chain, except that you're inserting value in it. And in our case, in the food value chain, we're trying to increase the amount of money that farmers are earning for their crops. That's kind of the value that we're, one of the values that we're trying to foster. And so our value chain coordinator, Mike, is working to create wholesale markets. He's connecting farmers to various wholesale markets, and those are kind of like the grocery stores that I mentioned, and, you know, the schools. We work with the schools. The public education department has been buying more local produce than ever before. So senior centers, you know, any place where we can also increase the places where farmers can sell their products.
That's one of the things that I actually do when I go into a supermarket. If there's a clerk standing by, I say, where are these peaches from? And, you know, they'll tell you if they know. A lot of time they do, whether they're from Colorado or California or just down the street.
Yeah, that's a really good thing to do. And I think it's something that, you know, people can do at restaurants, too. They can ask for local. And so if it's, I mean, you can't ask for local tomatoes in the middle of January. But in August, you can encourage restaurants that you like to go to buy local.
So how are farmers doing in New Mexico? I mean, the farmers markets, which your Farm Revolution Farms, you're selling it at farmers markets. It's a community, even though you're all sort of competing against each other for apricot sales or whatever. But what is this community, especially in northern New Mexico, like, and how's it going?
I would say there's a fair amount of camaraderie with a lot of the growers and vendors. You know, like I think any group of people, there's always squabbles and people have their little feuds or whatever. But overall, I mean, most of the people that I see on a daily or weekly basis at farmers markets are, you know, friendly, and everyone's kind of got the same issues like Denise had mentioned. You know, it's like we're all dealing with the flea beetles, or we're all dealing with the squash bugs, or trying to time things so that, you know, they grow better. But no, it's a great community to be a part of. That's mostly why I enjoy the farmers markets. I mean, sometimes you're not even making that much money. You're just kind of standing around shooting the breeze with people. So, yeah.
Do you get to know your customers?
Yeah. There's a lot of repeat customers, a lot of, you know, diehards or whatever you want to call them. But yeah, there's, over the years, there's a lot of people that I enjoy seeing time and again.
Do you find that people are doing like canning and freezing and that kind of thing? Like, are they buying in bulk?
Sometimes, like, especially if I have a deal on like last year I had a bunch of winter squash and we were selling them for $1 a pound because they were just kind of, this is like January or February, they were kind of past their peak, but people were stocking up and like roasting them and freezing them in chunks, or buying radishes and pickling them and doing stuff like that. But I think a lot of that comes down to having spare time, which most of my customers don't have a lot of spare time to prepare meals and get ready for, you know, putting food up or whatever. I don't see that so much, but it does happen. I mean, that's something that I used to do a lot more of before I was farming full time.
Yeah, it's something we try to encourage customers to do. And we also work with Co-op Extension and their ICAN program. And ICAN is the Ideas for Cooking and Nutrition. And they often do food preservation classes with customers. And we do a lot of recipes and a lot of different kinds of outreach. And freezing is even easier than canning. So personally, I don't have the time for canning, but freezing is pretty easy because you're usually just, you know, blanching some green beans and throwing them in a bag. And what I always try to get people to think about is people are very well trained for freezing their chili, right? Nobody would dare only buy just enough chili for like the next week or 2 weeks. You've got a freezer full. And so, you know, we always try to encourage people to think along those terms and preserve the harvest into the winter.
What kind of support are you finding that farmers are asking for, and what are you able to provide?
Well, there's a number of things. As I mentioned, I think connecting them to wholesale markets is really important. So moving their product is, you know, of primary importance.
So you basically, like, what does that look like? So a farmer says, well, I have an awful lot of greens. Can you connect me with restaurants? And then you go to the restaurants and say, hey, there's this guy. I mean,
restaurants is a little bit different. Farmers usually will sell directly to restaurants because mostly anybody who touches product, you know, like a distributor, they've got to take a little piece. So if a farmer can deliver directly to restaurants, they're going to keep as much of the profit for themselves. So for local restaurant sales, we really encourage them just to, you know, deliver directly. They create their own relationships. Chefs also really enjoy the relationships that they have with farmers. But for larger volumes, it really depends on the volume of product. You know, so for food service, Sysco, we can move food through Sysco via, again, our value chain coordinator who would connect. We work with a distributor in Albuquerque called Pueblo Fruits, Inc. And Mike, all they have to do is call Mike, and Mike will connect them with the distributor and, you know, work with them on how much product they have. He also tends to work with farmers in the off season on production planning so that he can help them gauge, you know, how much of a certain product he can move. If they grow a ton of mustard greens, he's not going to have, people just don't really want mustard greens. People have tried, and, you know, there's just, so he can help them know, you know, what moves best, approximate prices, things like that.
So do farmers end up adjusting what they're growing according to those kinds of needs?
Yeah, they have been. And again, this is our first full year doing the value chain project, but they have been for sure. And especially with the schools, that's true as well.
One of the things that, again, from the outside, I mean, I'm so not a farmer, but that it seems to me that is a little bit of a tension is, on the one hand, it's great to have lots of small farms because there are things that you can do on farms when you're working at a small scale that's harder to do when you have some massive farm. But on the other hand, if you want to sell wholesale, you have to have an awful lot of product ready. So how do you resolve that?
Well, I think Alex can maybe talk, because Alex is a great example. He's a small farmer, but he's been doing a little more wholesale sales.
Yeah. Well, and in that sense, like, farmers markets are a good place to kind of test the water, so to speak, with like what does sell. Like, so you grew too many beds of mustard greens and no one's buying mustard greens, but those salad greens sell out every week, you know, so you just, next year or next month, you kind of adjust and plant less mustard and more salad, for example. But last year we moved at least a ton through Pueblo Fruits, a ton of radish. Out of three, I think. So it was a lot of radish, but
a literal ton of radish.
Yeah,
2,000
yeah.
pounds of radish. Okay.
Yeah, and it was like maybe mid-January or something, and I saw these guys at the Capitol, and Mike was there, and said he knew someone who would buy a ton of radish. So, but yeah, it's just kind of hard to tell sometimes too what's going to be a super bumper crop and what's going to fail, and usually it's what's in demand that fails and what's not in demand that is a bumper crop, but not always. So
yeah, and scale is tricky because, you know, we want to support small farmers and help them build their capacity to move a little bit towards medium scale, I guess you could say. But we also try to work with some of the larger farmers who can produce, you know, they just, and those tend to be the farmers in the southern part of the state or over near Clovis, where they have larger amounts of land. And so then they can grow a little bit more volume.
Now, you are, Alex, part of the Northern New Mexico Young Farmers Alliance, and there's a lot of Young Farmers Alliances all over the place these days. We think about the average age of farmers getting older and older each year, and ranchers as well. But there's a whole bunch of people who want to go into farming, and the disconnect is the land. How do you, because land prices are expensive, how do you deal with that? And how do organizations like this, if you do, kind of facilitate the people who want to farm being able to farm?
Yeah, and land cost, I mean, at least in New Mexico, is just one of the many barriers to entry, right? Like, because like Denise was saying, like, you can grow all this food, but then what are you going to do with it? It's like a ticking time bomb. So you got to have some sort of refrigeration. You've got to have a delivery truck, or you've got to have somebody driving from wherever the farm is. You know, I'm 10 minutes from here, which is fortunate for me. But I mean, if you're in Clovis or somewhere way out there, I mean, you've got to have a distribution channel. So, but the barriers here, I mean, land access is definitely a big one, but there is a lot of farmland that's very accessible if you just kind of become a part of your community. I mean, that's what I've seen through the years, is just, just farming in different locations, and then people just kind of open up their property or open up their resources to you almost immediately when they see what you're doing, you know. So mostly it's the infrastructure, though, I would say. You know, it's like getting everything where you can be at a location for quite a few years and then build what's needed for a farm, which is, you know, different outbuildings and water and potable water and different irrigation lines, and even acequias and stuff like that need to be improved. So it's not so much, at least for me and a lot of the people I know, it's the land is kind of there, and a lot of farmland owners are willing to lease land for next to nothing, if not a handshake and some produce. But it's really having the longevity and in that land and being able to set up a farm that's going to be there for a while. Cause with a lease land, that's tricky.
Well, and as with everything else in life, it's all about building relationships. You know, you can't just sort of come into a community and say, I'm here, can I do some land? As you say, it's like getting to know people.
No, and immediately, I mean, we were farming in the last 5 years and at least five different spots, if not more. And people just see that and they're like almost astounded, you know. They're, oh, my dad used to farm that field and he used to put this in and that. And so it's like people get kind of excited, but also curious, you know. They see you planting, like we were planting garlic in October, and somebody stops by and they're like, what are you guys doing? You're planting? What are you, you know, they're just kind of confused because it's fall and you're planting. But just having that conversation with the neighbors, and then they know that you've got a field of garlic and you'll be back in the spring to tend it. And it just, it forges a lot of relationships. But no, there's a ton of barriers to becoming a farmer. I mean, just financial incentive is the biggest, probably. You know, it's hard to make a decent living growing food.
Is everything you eat what you yourself grow?
I mean, a lot of it, but I don't grow that many crops. I mean, I'm probably growing like 20 different crops this year. So we do a lot of trading and bartering with other vendors, other farmers.
I've been wondering what it would take to have your entire diet be grown in northern New Mexico. You know, I'm thinking cheese, meat, vegetables, fruit. Although, I don't know, in the dead of winter, it might get a little tricky.
Yeah, you'd be eating some apples that were in storage for a while or something. But, I mean, most of the meat I eat is coming from local ranchers, because we'll trade, you know, say squash or whatever we have for meat. But yeah, it would take, I mean, and the food is more expensive when it's grown locally.
Yeah, it would take a lot of commitment, really. And I think there's been, you know, across the country and over the last number of years, there's been a lot of different kind of local food challenges where writers and different people have challenged themselves to do a local-only diet. And it would take, you know, a lot of commitment and...
And never going out to eat, probably.
Well, that too.
Yeah.
Right. And some money, you know, but it would be tough in winter and a lot, it would take a lot of commitment. One of the other things that we do that helps farmers a little bit, I mean, it's hard to even imagine, you know, as Alex was saying, for farmers who are leasing land, to be able to put in, to do improvements is a really big, it's a really important and challenging aspect. But we've been doing, this year we did some small grants for farmers. We called them LIFE grants, Local Innovation Farmer Enterprise Grants. And it was amazing. We awarded up to $3,000 to 9 or 10 farmers. And it's amazing what $3,000 each, what some of the farmers are able to do. Because I think they're some of the most, you know, inventive and creative problem solvers I know. So Alex actually received a grant from us, but there was a lot of need for cold storage. Just as Alex was mentioning, that's one of the things that really helps a farmer step up from the smallest level of production where you're just selling everything you've got week by week to being able to really, you know, put it aside when you need to. So we did quite a few grants that were that had different types of cold storage, and one that was for a water filtration system, and the farmer was super creative about the project that he put together. So a lot can be done with, you know, a little bit of help, but it also relies on their hard work, a lot of hard work there.
How do you do water? I mean, it's not only is there not a whole lot of water in northern New Mexico, but it comes in fits and starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of the field that I'm farming right now it's about an acre, and it's all in drip irrigation, and then some of it I have sprinklers that I can use if I need to for certain things, but mostly it's just drip irrigation, drip tape, drip lines. And then I have that set up on timers, irrigation timers. So essentially that comes on in the middle of the night.
Right.
And then, yeah.
And you also use water catchment.
Yeah, at some locations. Yeah, not at that location.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What would it look like to, do you guys think, I mean, I'm trying to imagine a local food system, which is what you guys are all dedicated to, being much more kind of like the primary way that we get food. What would it take to do that?
Like, I'm just imagining like right. some apocalyptic like thing with the food system. I don't know.
Yeah, it seems, you know, it's funny that you say that because like humans seem like we seem to respond to crisis, right? Yeah. You know, that's when we get our act together. So I don't know what it would take to really, you know, I mean, if we were self-sustaining, like if...
Or a little closer to it than yeah. we are now.
I mean, I will say when there was the romaine recall, like a year, I think it was last summer, and I had a ton of romaine that we were selling, and somebody said something, I think it was another farmer, and they were like, oh, do you think this is going to hurt sales? And it was the complete opposite. Like right. people were coming to the market, and they already knew me as the guy that had lettuce at that market, but... they were making jokes and stuff like, oh, this isn't from Salinas or whatever, you know? So I think it is in a way those kind of like little,
catastrophes.
Yeah. Right. It's like, then people are like, oh, I better get this safe romaine. Cause he picked it today and it's been washed and he's using potable water and we know exactly where it came from. It's not a field full of people picking it. It's just one or two people, you know? So I don't know. I mean, it's dedication from people with the means to do it, but...
I think what's hard is, you know, just thinking about the general population and food, the industrial food system, the way things have gone over the last years is that, you know, as Americans, we don't spend a lot on food, right? We've become accustomed to going to the grocery store and a 3-pack of, you know, romaine lettuce that's been from California, you know, the one area in California, and... I don't know how much those farm workers were paid, not very much to pick that lettuce, but we've been really conditioned to think that food should be cheap. And that's a problem. And it's hard, you know, even working in this industry and as close with farmers as I do, you know, everybody's got a budget. So I can't buy all of my food. I mean, now actually it's a little easier because my kids are out of the house, so I'm not feeding 3 hungry teenagers. But, you know, especially then it was really like I couldn't, you know, if potatoes are $3 or $4 a pound and you wanted to buy a lot of potatoes, it adds up. And so, but we make choices. And I think something that people could do, but it's pretty hard, they could try growing their own food too, which I haven't been very successful with. And then I think they would have a whole new appreciation for the cost of food and how hard it is to grow it. And
oh, yeah. I mean, we have this thing called the $5 tomatoes,
right.
which is you buy a plant and you water the living heck out of it and it barely comes up and then you have a few tomatoes, but yeah.
But you're so happy with those tomatoes.
You're happy with those tomatoes and they taste very good, but so do the ones at the farmer's market.
Yeah. A long time ago, I decided I would prefer to give my money to farmers and not even try to do it myself.
Now, there are programs that you're working with for people on public assistance to be able to have access to fresh food.
Yes, there are. And that's a really important point because even though we're talking about sort of the cost of food, the reality, you know, is that it is a little bit more expensive. And it depends on, and that also depends on where you are. So in Santa Fe, because we work with markets and farmers across the state, so in Santa Fe, where everything is a little bit more expensive, the prices at the farmer's market are a little bit more expensive. Locally grown produce in Farmington and Aztec and Clovis is not necessarily It's definitely not as expensive as it is here in Santa Fe, and it may not even be more expensive than what it is at the grocery store. So that's one thing. But there's the WIC program, which is the Women, Infant, and Children program run by the Department of Health, which has a farmers market nutrition program. There's a senior farmers market nutrition program that gives out checks for low-income folks. And then there's the SNAP programs, which the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and Double Up Food Bucks, which helps people. Double Up allows anybody using their EBT card to buy one and get one, basically. It's like taking 50% off the cost of locally grown. It has to be New Mexico-grown produce. And that's both at farmers markets and at about 10 or 12 grocery stores across the state. And farm stands.
And do they get used? In other words, are people really taking advantage of that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This is our, the program started in earnest in 2015. That was the first year there was a federal grant available. We had piloted it previously, but people are spending about, I think last year was the first year that more than $1 million was spent in EBT and Double Up at farmers markets and grocery stores on local food.
In New Mexico.
In New Mexico.
Very interesting.
Right. And the Santa Fe Farmers Market, I think, also hit a milestone that over the many years that they've been running the program, they just passed $1 million last year in their total EBT and Double Up sales. So people are learning about the program all the time and using it, and it's really helpful both for the shoppers and the farmers.
And I think and hope the long-term health of their families.
That's the idea. Yep.
Yeah. Alex, if you could like wave a magic wand and have things just the way you want them, how many acres would you be farming? Like what would your life look like if you could just kind of set it up?
Just for me personally, the magic
yeah.
wand? I mean, it'd be pretty much what I'm doing right now. It's about three quarters to one acre. And that's about enough for one person to manage by themselves. I mean, even less than that would be better, but that's pretty ideal. I mean,
and you can make a living?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I have about 60 beds that are 100 feet each. And, of all those beds, I mean, I've got, let's say like the carrots right now I'm digging up and probably 300 to 500 pounds of carrots per bed at, you know, $2 to $4 a pound. It's like just the simple math there is like, you can get like $500 to $1,000 per bed. You know, if you're keeping everything really well tended. So yeah, it's plenty of work. I mean, I wouldn't want to be doing more like
right,
I did
right.
in the past.
Meaning what?
Oh, like last year we were farming like closer to 2.5 acres total. And that was just crazy. And in the past I've farmed different locations that were 20, 30 minutes apart. And this year I'm just doing one location in a field in La Cienega and then the other three greenhouses at my house. So even a little less would, you know, if I could make more money off the food, then maybe I'd grow less. But it's a kind of a sweet spot right now for production, I think.
Very interesting, because, I mean, the American mythology is grow bigger and better. And you're really showing kind of different model.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's small scale regenerative agriculture, you know, it's just pretty simple stuff.
One of the things that I think is so interesting lately is that, I mean, I've been doing a podcast for years on regenerative agriculture called Down to Earth, which people can find it on the Radio Cafe website, radiocafe.org. And recently, I've been reading the term regenerative agriculture in the mainstream media like never before. It's sort of everywhere, and it's been really interesting. It's like what you guys have been doing for a long time is finally starting to seep into the consciousness of a lot more people.
That, and I think more new and beginning farmers are starting to realize that you do have to actually fill out the USDA survey. You have to you have to get a farm number. You have to put yourself out there, because otherwise you don't get counted, and then they just think that everyone's farming 10,000 acres, you know? So, I mean, I had a phone call from the USDA a month ago and told them I was farming 1 acre and how much I paid for it and what I was doing and what I was growing, and they put it down on their thing and it's part of the survey and it comes out for state land value. And I mean, it's important stuff. And then I think something that you touched on earlier too was the average age of farmers increasing pretty much since the 80s, I think. And now for the first time in 30 years, it's actually, it's shifted 1 year younger.
Right.
So instead of 66, it's like 65 now or something, you know? So you're starting to see more new and young farmers, but yeah, it's still a challenge, so.
Yeah, regenerative ag is, I mean, I wasn't even really aware of it as a term until, I don't know, maybe 3 years ago. And then all of a sudden, you know, it's like when you learn a new word and then you hear it everywhere. And I think one of the other things that I hope is maybe starting, you know, it takes a while to get when a new idea for it to really catch on. But there's also so much that goes with, you know, as people become more concerned about climate change and what a difference it can make taking care of the soil and the nutrients that regenerative agriculture, what that does for soil. And so I think that's another important part that maybe is helping it get a little bit more traction.
Right. Well, not only is the soil healthier when you don't put all that crazy chemical stuff in it, but it sequesters carbon like gangbusters.
Exactly.
So it's a very interesting moment to be a farmer, not to mention an eater, not to mention a citizen in this crazy country. Anything else that you want to let people know before we go?
Sure. Well, I just want to say, as far as Local Food Connects NM Month, that we hope people will just really get excited about local food. We want them to check out local food in whatever way makes sense for them. So whether that's going to their local farmers market and talking with growers, that's excellent. If it's trying to grow something in their backyard or buying seeds and working with their kids, if it's trying a new recipe, try a new food once a week each month in August. And there's a lot of different events that are going to be happening at farmers markets across the state. Also, August 4th through the 10th is National Farmers Market Week. So within Local Food Connects Month is National Farmers Market Week. And so farmers markets will be having all kinds of different educational activities and things going on. And social media, people can interact with us on social media, where we'll be posting a fun fact, food and farming fact, every day for the month of August.
And that's farmersmarketsnm.org.
That is our website, exactly. And they can also go to Double Up NM for information about the Double Up Food Bucks program. And we have a slightly different name on our on our Facebook page. Maybe it's Farmers Markets.
You can get to it from farmersmarketsnm.org, and okay, it has a link to your Facebook page.
Perfect.
So I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Denise Miller of New Mexico Farmers Marketing Association and Farmer Alex Pino of Revolution Farm. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Building resilient children, families, and communities through early childhood support and partnerships, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks LANL Foundation for their sponsorship of this program. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.